Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Business news, views, and insights from across the globe.
Welcome, everyone, to Hidden Growth Champions, our podcast series. Today in our studio, we've got Benny Van Roy. Benny is a financial services executive. He's had an illustrious career, and currently he is the managing director of Access Bank South Africa. You may have heard or seen in the news that Access Bank has acquired a banking entity here in South Africa and has come into this market and operates throughout the African continent and even beyond. So it's an exciting organization. I'm sure it's an exciting role, Benny, and would love to hear more from you. But first things first, please introduce yourself. Tell us more about yourself.
Good morning, Saul. In South Africa, at least, good morning. Thank you for having me on the show. It's a real privilege to join you today. I'm a very boring accountant from a background point of view. I always tell my children the story when they ask me why did I decide on an accounting career, that at school, I wasn't great at writing essays. I didn't like writing essays, but I was much better at maths. So I decided to follow some career where I can do lots of calculations and so forth, write very few essays. So that's what I studied. But unfortunately, at this stage, I'm writing essays about calculations I didn't perform. So it shows you how your career changes and how life changes. I'm an accountant. I did my internship at PricewaterhouseCoopers, and I spent the majority of my career in the banking environment. Spent about 6-7 years at APSA or Barclays when Barclays acquired the majority stake in APSA in the early 2000s. Then I spent about 4 years at the JD Group, a listed furniture retail business with a sizable financial services component. Eventually acquired by Steinhoff, I left the business in 2014. And I joined the state-owned Land and Agricultural Bank of South Africa, known as the Land Bank, and had a phenomenal 4 years there trying to enable the agricultural space. Very successful 4 years with the Land Bank, was one of the leading state-owned entities in South Africa. Raised copious amounts of funding from DFIs, the national markets, local capital and debt market, very profitable institution. No governance failures that you associate with most state and entities in South Africa. And then I left the Land Bank in 2019 to join what then known as Grow Bank, to convert Grow Bank into a commercial agricultural bank. So very much passionate about people, passionate about enabling people, the banking space, the banking sector, and our bank can genuinely be used to achieve objectives like social upliftment, environmental and social responsible lending practices, and just enable people to make a meaningful difference in their lives. I think if I can summarize my career and big career revelations that I've had was, as a leader, the more you grow into leadership roles, it's not so much about yourself, but about how you can enable other people. I'm sure we get to that when during the conversation. But very comfortable in my own skin, comfortable with the position, comfortable being a CEO and being a leader of people, and trying to, especially from a South African perspective, to take completely diverse team members and form and shape them into a unified team that can unlock so many beautiful synergies that we tend to do in the South African context.
No, that's fantastic. Benny, we can really resonate with this, you know, in our work. We always look for and can recognize distinctive organizations. And there's just a different vibe, a different feel around these organizations. And very often we can point to exactly what you've said. It's that outward leadership. It's that enabling others. It's not just about me and what I can achieve, but it's what the team achieves, what the team learns, and what they are capable of doing even beyond their own aspirations of what they thought was possible. So that sense of distinctiveness is certainly not a lone sport. It's a team sport, in fact. So there's a lot of there are many lessons I imagine we can learn from your career, from your various experiences, whether at the Land Bank or in private financial institutions. But I wanted to talk a little bit about your more recent experience, and that is with Access Bank, and then we'll dial back into some of the earlier ones. I've really enjoyed, for example, reading Leaving the Tarmac, the autobiography of the founder of Access Bank, when he speaks about that very soul-shaping experience and understanding what it really means to create something that's distinctive, that's different. And that seems to have kind of permeated the growth of this institution right from the beginning. It's never a me too. It's never, let's just enter a new market because it just, the numbers are just right. There's always something bigger than that. There's always a bigger aspiration. So maybe talk to us a little bit about the organization, your role, and how do you see Access Bank building this very distinctive organization, both on the African continent and beyond it?
I think there's a few, there are a few parts to the answer. Grow Bank used to be known as the South African Bank of Athens. The bank was established in, I think, 1947 as a Greek community bank, majority controlled by the National Bank of Greece, which is kind of the equivalent of the South African PIC, Public Investment Corporation. It was set up to be a Greek community bank, servicing or solely focusing on the well-being of the specific community in South Africa. When things changed in Greece post the Greek crisis, the National Bank of Greece decided to divest from some of its international investments, and South African Bank of Assets was identified as one of the investments that they want to divest from. Then the bank was acquired by a consortium consisting of three shareholders with the sole aim of converting this bank from a Greek community bank into an agricultural community bank. So still a community bank. So what's a community bank? What are the characteristics of a community bank? Is there such a close relationship between the bank and the customers, because there are so many similarities, cultural similarities from a Greek community bank perspective, because the bank obviously appointed a number of Greek and Cypriot nationals to serve the community. In the agricultural community bank, lots of agricultural specialists, agronomists and colleagues, staff that genuinely understand the agricultural space and can relate to the agricultural community in a language that they understand. So that's the community bank part. Now, things changed in Grow Bank, and the shareholders lost the appetite for a continued investment in the bank. And the bank was approached by Access Bank Nigeria to acquire a controlling stake in the bank. It was quite a involved process, because to a bank is a highly regulated, or the banking industry is a highly regulated industry. And in order to conclude such a transaction, there are multiple regulatory approvals that have to take place. The transaction had to be approved by the Nigerian Central Bank, had to be approved by the South African Reserve Bank, the Competition Commission, and the Minister of Finance. And all of that took quite a bit of change, took quite a bit of time to approve the transaction eventually. And it took about 9 months from the moment that the transaction started to the moment that full regulatory approval was secured. And in fact, as you've mentioned, the bank was rebranded to Access Bank South Africa in the middle of June, about a month ago, just less than a month ago. So my role has actually changed quite dramatically during the 2 years that I've been at the bank, from being a catalyst for change to convert the bank into an agricultural bank, to playing a leading role in driving the execution of the transaction, which was a life-saving transaction for Grow Bank, and now finding ways to integrate the legacy of the institution, because legacy is important, the culture is important. Culture gets shaped over years in any organization. And as a CEO, you don't really change culture, you shape the culture, and you shape the culture into what's necessary to make this organization a success. So from being a catalyst for change and converting the bank into agricultural space to focusing with military precision on executing a transaction, the focus has now shifted to taking this community bank principle and finding new communities. And what are the communities we've identified in South Africa? And that's where the Access Bank story and the Access Bank legacy comes into play. It's pretty much a uniquely distinctive African-owned bank. The word African bank in South Africa sometimes refers to another commercial bank. So African bank is, in this instance, refers to a bank with its roots in Africa. And what are some of the principles that Access Bank have adopted? Community banking, agency banking are critical in their success story. And also the attitude that you adopt when you expand into Africa is critical. A lot of South African corporates expanding their world into Africa or their business into Africa are focused on, if you look at the triple bottom line principles, are focusing on the monetary component only. How much money can we make? So let's go into a new country and see how much money we can generate, because Africa is a continent full of opportunities, and it's a very challenging continent to do business, but lots of opportunities. So we must be able to explore, to take advantage of it and generate a lot of profit. Access Bank focus is more to look at what difference can we make? What difference can we make to a community? And that's where the issues of social upliftment and and since in environmentally and socially responsible lending come into play. Now, it's my philosophy and view that if you want to be successful, you have to make a difference. Generating profits is a consequence of doing the right things, looking after your staff, looking after all your stakeholders, showing that you care, showing that you want to make a difference. And that's part and parcel of the Access Bank philosophy. So that's the philosophy that they bring into South Africa, wanting to make constructive and contribute to constructive change and make a meaningful difference to the lives of people. And then integrating that with the Access Bank South Africa or Grow Bank or Bank of Athens culture of being a community bank, serving the community. So identifying the communities and serving them. So who are the communities that we want to serve? From a retail perspective, we would want to focus on African-based diaspora, so immigrants making South Africa their home. So to a large extent, we want to be the bank of choice for everyone making a living in South Africa, whether a South African citizen or not. And then in the corporate or commercial space, supporting in a different community, being companies that have trading partners across the continent. In the agricultural space, as an example, our biggest trading partners still reside somewhere on the continent. Not yet in Europe or the Far East or the States. And it's to enable and facilitate and streamline and simplify being able to transact with a counterpart sitting on the continent. Now, Access Bank has a daily position. They operate at this stage in 12 countries, by the end of the year, probably closer to 15 African countries. So they're likely to be counterparties from South African corporate sitting in countries where Access Bank has a presence. We would then be able to simplify transactions and relationships between the various counterparts and identify those opportunities. And that's what the Access Bank acquisition of Grow Bank introduced to South Africa. My view has always been that if you want to be successful as a bank in a very competitive banking landscape in South Africa, you have to do something different. You have to focus on something specific. You have to find a niche. And Access Bank's niche is clearly on using the incredible distribution network across the continent to focus on African-based immigrants, as I've mentioned, South Africa, and also companies trading across the continent.
You know, Benny, you've raised something really, really important when we think about organizations that are successful and very much centered around the customers. We almost without fail find a niche, find an insight that they have centered on that others do not understand, do not see, do not recognize. So very much resonate with what you've said. In fact, in one of the studies we've done, we found it sometimes can take up to 10 years for an organization to become truly and deeply customer-centered, truly understanding its customers, truly understanding what, in your case, the diaspora truly, truly needs in order to serve it really well, and then to only then to amplify it across many, many countries. So we're very keen to see what the bank will do next and where it's able to apply that distinctiveness in new markets. I guess with that comes the kind of the external perspective that says you're doing it in what is potentially some of the most challenging times on the African continent, and possibly for some of the most opportune time. There's never, you know, the return on investment on innovation in recessionary times has been proven time and time again to be higher than in times of growth and abundance. So when we think about that challenging environment, when we think about taking the lead, taking the opportunity at this time, rather than waiting for a more stable, a clearer, you know, external environment, how do you go about managing for growth, managing for that kind of customer centricity in this challenging environment? What are some of the things that you've seen, that you've experienced, and that you've led as an executive in financial services that speak to that?
I think the critical success factor is you have to understand that solutions for customers, for stakeholders, are not developed in fancy offices and ivory towers in beautiful cities across the world or across South Africa. Solutions are developed in conjunction and collaboration with your stakeholders and customers. It's a little bit more difficult in the virtual environment, but definitely still possible. But you need to don't ordinarily think that you have the solution to all your customers' problems without spending time and actually taking time and effort. So what we've specifically done in the retail space is we formed a number of little working groups and client focus groups where we spend time, afternoons, spending time with them in these groups, understanding what exactly do they want? Why do they have, what are the experience from the existing bank or financial services provider? What are the positive experiences? What are the negative experiences? Why would they consider changing their bank? What are they looking for in a new bank? What products do they want? What are their basic needs? And the more of those discussions that take place at collaboration events, the more you start shaping solutions. Now, there's no real, nothing is unique in a banking product. I mean, a loan is a loan and a bank account is a bank account. So I'd really like to see a bank test showing me that they've got a unique product. If it is a first, it gets replicated quite quickly. It's very little unique. But understanding the environment that your customers or stakeholders operate in, the challenges and finding ways to address that. And surprisingly, it's sometimes more about the how than the what, how you serve them. And then it's also about, you made the point, but showing that care, showing that you genuinely care and you are invested in their future. As a small bank, it's probably easier, but you're also a growing institution. So it's very easy to come across in your collaboration with customers that you want to grow with them. Because look at us, we're a small bank. Look at you, you're a relatively small business, but you have ambitions. You want to achieve your ambition. So let's take hands and see if we can convert this into a success story from both sides. So that's very important in any environment, even more so important in the current environment. You have to show that ability to that you care, that you understand that a COVID environment, we don't know how long it's still going to last in our country or globally. It's been very unpredictable. It takes a lot of courage to be a leader and to lead an organization in the current environment. But you need to show that you care. So if your customers experience concerns due to things beyond external factors beyond their control, such as lockdowns or embargoes on certain products or a ban, alcohol sale bans, whatever it may be, that if your clients in those specific industries or trading in those specific industries being badly affected by lockdown or by the pandemic, if you show that you care by restructuring loans, as an example, payment holidays or payment moratoriums, you'll be surprised at the loyalty you experience on the other side. I mean, in such an environment, you have to think more about others and less about yourself. In fact, you, as a CEO, become the least important person in the room, not the most important person in the room. And if you continue to focus on enabling, showing that you care, making a difference, and you would have mentioned, I never even once mentioned the let's make money principle. It's more about the other things that you do, and you will be successful as a consequence of doing the right thing, as opposed to that being your main focus. And I keep on getting back to this, but it's been such a revelation in my career that the more you focus on doing the right thing, the more you're successful are as a business and an individual.
Now, Benny, that has significant implications for how you manage, right? How you make decisions. Who makes decisions? Well, one of the things that we've seen and sometimes quite concerning to see is how decision-making authority in organizations during the pandemic and very much still today has been pushed up, has been pulled right to either a single person, the CEO, the managing director, or in some cases, right up to board level. It's interesting to see how many organizations these days, boards are involved in executive decision making and not always for the right reasons. So what you're espousing is, I guess, in a way, is a different approach that says instead of pushing decision making up, it becomes more of decision making with. The role of the team becomes critically important. The kind of signals and information that a team can bring to inform the discussion to make the right decisions for your customers for the long term, not just for immediate expediency, is quite different. So perhaps share with us, what is your approach to decision-making and how are they relevant in these times in particular?
This principle is empowering your senior leadership. So I firmly believe that you have to empower your senior leadership and you have to support them when decisions need to be made. The pandemic has taught us that you have to be that it's such a dynamic environment and changes take place so quickly. There were times in the last year where I honestly didn't know what to expect when I wake up in the morning, what this day will hold for us or for me. So a few principles. The first one is transparency. If you are transparent and you provide as much information as you are capable of that you are aware of, then obviously you empower your decision makers to take better decisions. The more information we have, the better our decisions are. So I was extremely, still continue to be very transparent. Initially, we had was daily exco meetings, catch-up sessions, bi-weekly staff information sessions. And again, it's about information sharing. The more information is available, the better decisions you'll make, because you just have the benefit of so much more information. So empowering is the first part. Providing support and providing that the decisions that we'll make, we'll make right decisions, sometimes we'll make wrong decisions, because specifically in financial services, you make decisions trying to predict the future. Mm-hmm. If I grant you a loan, I'm taking a decision on your ability to repay me in the future with information at disposal now. It's almost like you're taking some sort of a bet or a punt on your ability to repay. Yes. So that when decision making goes south, that you're still there to support. You understand why the decision was the wrong decision. You learn from it and you move forward. Look, eventually as CEO, you're the ultimate decision making. You take the responsibility and you have to embrace the responsibility. You have to want to be in the position. It's almost a desperation to be in the position and want to take the decisions. But if you can't take all the decisions on your own, there has to be collaborative decision making. So these frequent communication sessions enabled us an exco team to discuss the challenges we faced, discuss the decisions that we had to take. And that's, I guess, one of the beautiful parts of South Africa is because we have so many diverse people, culturally diverse, religiously diverse, diverse languages. People have different perspectives, and these perspectives should be shared in order to enhance decision making. I tend to stay very calm under pressure. I don't scream, I don't shout, I don't abuse, I don't swear at people. And setting that almost that environment where it's comfortable to share your views. Your views won't be held against you. Yes, we need to take important decisions, but let's get all the views on the table. And once you dissect this, and if you can't get to a collaborative decision, then obviously as a CEO, you are responsible to take the final decision, and you live and die by that. But those are important principles: communication, collaboration, empowering, and sharing as much information as you have at your disposal. Understanding that you need to be dynamic in decision making, because changes take place not even on a daily basis, sometimes on an hourly basis. And you need to be flexible and adaptive enough to take those decisions as and when necessary. Point is, you can't shy away from decisions. When you need to make a decision, you have to take a decision. People prefer bad news above no news. When you need to inform somebody of something, even if it's bad news, do it in the most respectful and honest way, but don't shy away from it. Don't postpone taking a decision or communicating a decision because you are concerned by the response that you get from the other side. The best you can do is to explain yourself and to be respectful, understand that you need to, whatever you need to communicate, there must be a lot of dignity involved, and people won't take all your decisions in the spirit of the communication style that you've adopted, and especially when there's an impact on people. It's an extremely difficult situation, but as your approach and the way you do it still can still make a meaningful difference.
Benny, when you spoke about decision-making, you introduced the concept of learning. And I wanted just to talk a little bit about that. You know, in the old days, we used to speak about strategy making and strategy learning. They were literally on the opposing sides of the process. Today, we find that strategy making, the decision process that follows that, or that's inherent in that, is very much linked to learning. It's part of the same cycle. It happens virtually at the same time or in very close proximity to it. So for example, when I think about the kind of decisions that we need to make in a challenging environment, it's very easy to not think of the environment itself, to almost accept that it is challenging and that it will remain challenging. And therefore, the kind of decisions that we make keep on following the same rules. They keep on, the frame within we make those decisions do not change. When we think about learning, you have to challenge your own understanding of the environment. Suddenly, what might seem as a challenging environment could actually be the telltale signs of deeper and more fundamental disruption that's taking place. So holding the fort, becoming defensive, making decisions to protect the core, whether it's an investment decision that you make, whether it's around lending, or whether it's a more fundamental decision about, you know, the culture of your own organization, the decisions you're going to reach is going to be quite different. So I guess the question I'm asking is, when you look at the current environment and the way we make decisions in this environment, are you seeing more of the challenging environment, but more of the same? Or are you seeing an environment that is in fact being disruptive, that is quite different? And therefore, while it may seem on the surface to be challenging, we have to think very differently. We have to learn differently. and therefore arrive at different decisions.
Absolutely. And again, it's due to the constant change and dramatic and material changes that are taking place on just on a continuous basis. You just can't predict the future at this stage. I mean, that's kind of in human nature. We want to predict the future. We want certainty. We don't want to live under a cloud of uncertainty on a continuous basis. And that's what the pandemic has taught us. And key learnings is how quickly changes take place and how quickly changes can influence and impact, have an impact on a business. And when you're moving away from growing to surviving and what's necessary to survive. So approach that we adopt in decision making and how we, what we learn from the approach that we adopted is in my mind more important than what decision you've taken, because you take a decision given a set of facts or circumstances at your disposal, you can't predict the future. You can think you can, but you can't. So even if your decision is wrong, admit it, understand that was it the approach that I adopted, or was it simply due to the facts that I had at my disposal that I took a certain decision, or that a team took a certain decision? So I think the approach to decision making has evolved. I think the approach will continue to evolve. And definitely of the strong view that collaborative decision making as opposed to individual decision making will continue to play a key and critical part going forward. And as a leader, you need to, and that's also part and parcel of one of the earlier responses I gave of that empowerment principle. If your leadership and organization and individuals feels like they play a part in decision-making, they own the decision, and it's so much easier to execute the decision as opposed to when it's a random instruction from somewhere in a top floor in an ivory tower, and this is what we're going to do. So the more ownership there is of decisions, the more I feel I'm part of the solution as opposed to part of the problem, I think the end result will be significantly better than a more dictatorial style of decision making. But to me, approach critical, how many people are involved in this? It's not always possible. Sometimes you need to take a decision in a split second and you accept that and you take those decisions. But still, the more people are involved in the decision making, the more ownership there is and the easier it is for those decisions to be executed.
So with that in mind, and perhaps just quoting one of my favorite futurists who agrees with you that the future can't be predicted, and Nancy Giordano, she speaks about the fact that we're just 1% in, that this level of disruption is just the beginning of, and therefore our ability to learn, to reshape and take different decisions and accelerate this process, become more skillful in it, is critical for us. With that in mind, when you think about people in the organization, people who are trying to innovate, people who are trying to, and you see the signals, and you see that we can't do more of the same, and you see the potential to participate in, to create something new, even if it at some point becomes a threat to the current core business, at some point it may even become the replacement of years down the line. For those individuals, for those catalysts in the business, what are some of the lessons you want to share with them? What are some of the insights that you think will be helpful to them as they are looking outward and seeing those opportunities, those moments of learning, and that possibility of creating the new?
I think the first answer to the question is that organization needs dreamers and innovators. And you want to encourage those people to continue to dream, to continue to innovate, and to never let go of their dreams. It's important. Never give up on them. You can achieve and fulfill those dreams and visions inside an organization. Clearly easier outside an organization if you're on your own, but there are all sorts of insecurity issues that you need to contend with. So there's definitely encourage people to think innovatively, to dream, and you can find ways. You can have an innovation hub. You can have monthly innovation competitions where people can submit their ideas and so forth to improve the organization. These are simple things, but it's creating that atmosphere and that environment we encourage innovation and thinking to take place. So the second part is, as a leader, you have to be receptive to those. You need to realize that you don't have the answers to everything. You don't have the solutions for everything. And sometimes the simplest solutions are the best and the most innovative and can make the most meaningful difference to an organization. Next thing I want to focus on is that as a leader, any environment, innovating environment or challenging environment, you need to realize that the organization's objectives and ambitions are always more important than the individual's aspirations and objectives. So you must be prepared to sacrifice yourself for an organization or for others. That's a difficult concept and difficult principle, because difficult for us as humans is to get to the point where you understand I'm doing something that's in the best interest of the organization, but not in the best interest of myself. And if you don't adopt that, you have run the risk of completely suppressing any innovator or any entrepreneur in your organization, because the ideas may result in something that make you feel pretty much uncomfortable, which is not necessary, because if you understand that your responsibility lies with the organization and acting in the best interest of the organization, you should always be on the lookout for opportunities to find new ways, innovative ways, maybe not in the banking sector, innovative products, but innovative products in other areas that will be for the benefit of the organization. So encourage that. Understand that some of those ideas may make you feel uncomfortable, may not be in the best interest of yourself, but don't stop anyone from pursuing and continuing with the innovative thinking and being entrepreneurs, because we need that in the organization.
That's really valuable. And Benny, I really want to thank you for taking time to speak to us today. It's been a fascinating conversation, and the kind of experience and insights that you brought will be incredibly valuable for our audiences. Thank you for that, and thank you for taking part in Hidden Growth Champions.
You're more than welcome, sir. Thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Join us next time for more business news, views, and insights from across the globe.